welcome her.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's it.
Short. That's what I am, short. I was born short. My name is Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a grateful alcoholic this morning. I had pneumonia about 3 weeks ago and lost my voice, and I thought, can you believe that? You know, God sets this up for me to come here, and I lose my voice. My great opportunity to tell you my story. Fascinating. To me. Someone asked me if I was nervous, and I said, no, this is the size of my home group. I love those small, intimate meetings where everybody gets to share. Before I lose my voice, it's really important that I thank some people for bringing me here. And I want to thank the committee, first off. Judy, you did a great job of communication. It was beautiful. And I wish I could just pass it around because it was incredible. And Mike made me feel really welcomed. And I tell you, I love this speaker thing here. I'm going to wear it to other conferences. strangers just come up and hug you, you know. And they say, when are you going to speak later? And I said, anyway, I want to thank the committee, and I have a lovely mug and a fruit basket, and I really appreciated it. Am I that short? Okay. Where's Wayne? I think Wayne's shorter than me. We all make fun of him, but I want to thank Patsy, too. You know, you come from out of town, and you just don't know who you're going to get. And I'm so lucky I got her. The very first night, I have a problem with walking, and the very first night she drove me down here, and I wanted to get out, and she said, be careful. And I said, well, thank you. And she said, well, they don't like litter around here, so look all down. She said, okay, I didn't even. And I've always had the philosophy that revenge is better than Christmas. But anyway, I want to tell you, I think that Patsy is a really good example that even those with great emotional and mental disorders can recover. My only regret that I shared that with you is that she gets the last word in. I do want to thank some people that took the time to reach out to me. One of them is Jim B. He's sitting over here someplace. So came up and started talking to me, and I really appreciated that. And there was another guy. I forgot his name, of course, but him and I got to talking about aerospace. And he worked in aerospace, and so did I, which should make you really nervous. Because we worked on the defense end. Should make you extremely nervous. Anyway, J.D. and Mary Pearl. Patsy was late. It's okay, Patsy. So I went over to the restaurant. I never met the meal. And anyway, I was sitting there alone, and not Mary Pearl, she's a hoot. By the way, I am not the Al-Anon speaker, in case you didn't read the program. although I qualify, and actually have been in that program longer than AA, so thank God for Al-Anon. Anyway, she came over, and she introduced herself and asked me to come sit with her, because she saw me sitting alone. That's what AA is about for me, as you begin to notice people around you. And you begin to see what's happening in the world around you instead of my own little self-centered space. And Sharon and Bill and Joanne, we had dinner last night, and I see why Patsy is the way she is. Her friends, you know, you are who you hang out with. And I had a wonderful lunch with Fran and where's Cindy? Cindy. I think she knew I was going to introduce her. she has 4 months. And that's okay. She'll come in thinking I forgot, and I'll get her. I want to acknowledge my Springfield friends, and they're very important to me. I'm from Springfield. Actually, I was born in Wichita, Kansas, but I was raised in Springfield, Missouri. And my whole family's there. And about 1991, I brought my mom home, and I've been coming back since 87. But I brought my mom home to retire, and she had a stroke. And I went to the meeting that I'd always been going to, and I met some really precious people. Mary Ann V is sitting back there, and she reached out right away to me, gave me her hand, and helped me walk through that. And there's Elaine and Wayne and Marlene and my friend Lynn. My mother died in 92 at a bar home buried her, and he made all the flowers up. And my grandma would just kick my butt if she knew I was whining up here, so I'm going to straighten up here. And she's tough. She is. And she's worse than my sponsor, but anyway, wonderful people. When I go, I consider the Mustard Seed Group and the What's the Matter You as my home away from home. And they're wonderful. What's the Matter You, I really love that title. I think I'll start a meeting. What's the Matter You, there's nothing wrong with me. And Joe and Charlie were spectacular yesterday, and I love them. I love them a lot. I appreciate how they present the big book and, with humor and simplicity, and I really get a lot out of it. And I enjoyed Wayne Thursday night. I hope I can tell my story as simply and as eloquently as he did. And I hope you get the picture of what it used to be like, what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like today. That's how it's outlined in the book, and that's kind of like how I like to do it. As I said, I was born in Wichita, Kansas. By accident, really. My mother had moved there because my grandfather was there for a while. And he's from Greeley, Kansas, and he had a little feed store there, and so she went to stay with him with my father for about 6 months, and I was born there. And then we went back to Springfield, and that's where my mother was born. And my father was born in Ashgrove, Missouri. And all my family is in Springfield, Missouri. And so up until 9 years old, that's where I lived. Now, I had a lot of aunts and uncles. As a matter of fact, I had so many aunts and uncles on my mother's side of the family that where we lived became known as King Holler. And wherever I went, there was cousins, and I was very loved. And I spent a lot of time with my great-grandparents also. And I spent a lot of time with my mother's father, my Grandpa Timish, my Grandma Timish, who's still alive. And I felt very loved. And I never really had a problem until I got sober and went to therapy. But anyway, I convinced me I had a bad childhood. And I liked that in my first year of sobriety, and the reason that lying, you know, but if you had a childhood like mine. But anyway, really true, I wasn't an unhappy child. And my relatives loved me. And my mother and father, my mother was a cocktail waitress, and my dad was a bartender. And I was raised in bars. I liked them. Right from the beginning, I guess. But I did. I mean, my dad was a bartender all over town, and when he divorced my mother and remarried, his wife was a bartender. And she used to work at Lee Darden's over on Commercial Street. My dad and mom, when they were married, both worked at a place called the Townhouse, which was right next to it. Whoa! You look a little young, that's great. I didn't think that place was still around. But anyway, my mama sang on the radio, and I used to listen to her on Saturday nights at home, and sometimes they'd take me down there. You know, I fell asleep in the booth. I got my first bicycle in a bar. My dad was sitting by a place on St. Louis Street, which they've torn down, thank God. And so I got my first bike then. Never thought anything about it. Matter of fact, I think and I believe that my fascination with neon lights, signs, came from that period of time. If you ever wanted me as a little child to put me to sleep, just put a blinking Budweiser or something else over in the corner and I go into a trance, you know. When I was first sober, I'd drive by, you know, a bar, some of those lights would be on, I'd just zone out. Anyway, I blanked out. I think I was back in the bars, but as a child of three. Anyway, I really didn't see me having a problem. I love my relatives. I love Springfield. You know, they said our family was poor, but you know, we never went hungry. And they said we were poor, but we never went dirty. And they said we were poor, but we had a lot of love. And so I never saw myself suffering. I mean, beans and cornbread are still my favorite food, you know. And today they say add a little cheese, it's the best thing you can eat. But so I never knew that my mother and father's absence and their problems was a problem for me. My mother and father separated when I was five, and I continued to live with great-grandparents and grandparents. And my mother moved to California, and she was out there for a while, and my grandpa and grandma would take me out there to see her. And I don't remember very much about my mother. I remember a lot about my daddy, so I don't remember very much about her. And at 9 years old, my dad was living there, and I was living with my grandpa and grandma. And he was going to take me, and my grandpa was afraid he'd never see me again, and so he sent me out to my mother. I think of Springfield, and I think of fireflies and June bugs with strings on their little legs. But anyway, we were hateful children. But well, we here had fun with that. And you know, the only ethnic food they had in Springfield at that time was pork chops, I think. But anyway, they've got a restaurant every quarter now. You know what I mean? I love it. But so anyway, they sent me out there. It was the first time I ever really got mad at my grandpa. It was the first time I ever really talked back. And the first time my grandpa ever slapped me for talking back to my grandma. But I didn't want to go. I didn't want to go live with her. I really would have wanted. I wanted to stay there. I loved my grandparents. I had a clean bed, had meals. I knew where I was going to go. I was in school. I loved school. And I didn't want to go. And I had to go. So I go out there in Los Angeles, and my mother had married an Italian man. He had more teeth than I've ever seen a human being's head. My grandma asked me to describe him, and I said, he has got a lot of teeth. He was a handsome guy. He was a handsome man, you know. And they had just been married, so they lived in a one-room apartment. And there wasn't a lot of room for me. And so they put me in this little place where this lady was taking care of something like three other little kids. And they put me over there, and this was an Italian lady. And she cooked strange things, like zucchini. And I made strange things like figs. And I hated it. And I used to prefer to eat out in the clubhouse so I could throw that zucchini underneath the floorboards. And begin that I'd eat it, but I didn't like it there. And some things began to happen for me. That was a turning point in my life. I felt alone, and I felt like I was going to have to take care of myself the rest of my life. And I couldn't depend on anybody. My grandfather had abandoned me. My mother was married. And I thought it was going to be me. And by God, I better learn how to take care of myself. So they let me join the Boys and Girls Club, and I began to work out. Sorry. I don't know where that came from. As you can see, it's staying with me. But, I'm afraid this would happen, but anyway. I became tough. Yeah, short and tough, but anyway. Good God, Julie. Okay. Get it together. I'm doing okay up until then. That's cool. Okay. Time for my approval. Where is she? Anyway, I don't know how long I was there. I have no time frame in my mind. But I was there quite a while. But another thing kicked in, too, is I became the the force for good. And I took care of all the underdogs. It was little tiny kids there, and they cried a lot. And if anybody picked on them, then I'd bite them on the ankle. But no, I was a close vet, boy, I tell you. And that became another modus operandi for me. The rider of rights. You know, here's a white horse and a white hat. And so I was there for a while, and finally I did go back and stay with my mom and my new stepfather, and they fought a lot. And this defender of, you know, the underdog, they would fight, and my mother would call for my help. Now, okay, sure. And I would run in between them to help them, and I always got the pow, you know. And then my mother would say, go for the police. Okay, yeah, I don't know where they are, but I'll go, you know, and I'd rush for the back door, you know. And then she'd go, woohoo, go, don't go, and don't tell the neighbors. This went on a lot, you know, and I just thought, well, that means they love each other. So consequently, all my relationships have been the same. The more you yell, the more you love, you know. But anyway, every summer I go back to Missouri, see? I go back to see my daddy. And he moved to Kentucky. But every summer I go back there, and every summer I spend time with my grandpa. And it's went on like this for years. I didn't really drink. I watched them a lot, and I thought, that'll never happen to me. That'll never happen to me. Claudia Black, by the way, wrote a wonderful book about it. It'll never happen to me. And so when I was about 18, my grandfather passed away, and he had a massive stroke. My grandfather had a feed store called Fiddle Out Feed Store in Springfield, Missouri for many years on the corner of Campbell and Pacific. And he had sold that and set up his sons in a business, and he was out getting feed orders. He never would quit. He loved to work. I got that from him. I do like to work. And anyway, he had a massive stroke and he died. And that was a turning point for me. He was a great guy. He used to take me on that feed route with him, you know. And he loved to sing. He had a terrible voice. And he'd sing, just a closer walk with me. And boy, he'd just pound that foot, you know, and get me all stirred up, you know. And then he'd sing, on the old way across, you know. He was a great man. Loved him dearly. Anyway, I lost him. And another turning point, I was in college. And I had done well in school. I loved school. It was my greatest escape. And I had a good grade point average. I held offices. I was popular. I was never close to anybody. Had a lot of different groups I hung out with. Became kind of my story and in my life. Don't get close, don't get hurt. And so when he passed away, after things went downhill, I started drinking, and my mother's drinking escalated. And I dropped out of college, went to live with my father up in Sacramento, and my drinking really did escalate at that point. I gained weight. Didn't much care. I think for the next 18 years, I never wore a dress. I got myself some work boots, Levi's, and a flannel shirt, and a vest. That became my outfit. Didn't keep people away from me. Anyway, so I was up there for a while, and I got into some trouble. I wrote some bad checks. I always had this philosophy, if you had checks, you had money in the bank, so. But my father, he made me go and pay for all those, and he made me go around and face them. He just didn't mail them the money, I had to go do it. You know, didn't stop me from doing it again. I just didn't face them, you know, I went to jail. But, so it was there for a while, and I got into trouble and went back to live with my mother again, and the drinking escalated, and just kept on going like that, and I had different jobs. I worked for a bank, you know, poor bank, and I mean, here I write back checks, and I wanted to see how the system worked, and I wanted to work for them to see how they process those checks, and how fast it takes, you know, to get there, you know. I did a lot of things in my lifetime, and I don't know if that's alcoholic or not, you know, but I had a lot of different jobs. Yeah, I worked for Aerospace, which still today, I just laugh about that. But, I mean, if you want to know where all the drunks are, go to aerospace. That's where we were, you know. And had a good time there. My boss was all drunk. And I remember my boss one time, he came to me and he said, do you think you could come in on Monday and Friday for a walk? He said, the other women are getting a little upset that you're not here Monday through Friday. And I went, oh, God. All right. Like I'm doing him a favor. Well, if you insist, I'll be there. Anyway, that lasted a while. But working in aerospace, and I had 2 or 3 jobs at a time. You know, I drank a lot. I needed money. And so I had my own dog grooming business for a while. That was exciting. I like being my own employer. You know, you set your own hours, you know. And if your customers don't follow those hours, they can just leave, you know. I was very successful. One guy came and I was late, and, oh, he was so mad, you know. I thought, well, just take your dog and go. He was on his way to work in Beverly Hills. He said, he begged me to take that dog. I said, okay, maybe I will, I don't know. So that kind of an attitude, that's very hard to hang on to your customers. You only get them one time, you know. I didn't have a lot of repeat business. I also sang. I was, my father's side of the family, his mother was from the Carters, so I think I come from that natural. And I sang for a long, long time. I sang in a trio, folk singing trio, and I sang in an all-women's band, and here's how we had a manager, and the first thing she negotiated was a tab. The second night, they renegotiated. It was always after the first night. So, and I think I too high, we just thought our own, but anyway, yeah. And took more breaks. And, I love fun. And then that, they talk about that invisible line, you know, that you cross. And I think I just kind of, I tripped over it. Fell right into it, you know. But when you get into any really serious trouble, if you call going through relationship after relationship and writing bad checks. And I went to jail once for bad checks. And, I never really wanted to do that again. And the pitiful part is that I dragged out of my closet my old blue and white checked outfit that I had worn in high school. And they sent me to Civil Brand, which is a women's prison. And you don't wear that outfit there. I mean, you know, they see you coming, you know. And so I got into a lot of trouble there and got into solitary confinement for hitting someone because they were picking on someone, you know. Going to take care of somebody else again, you know. So I had this solitary confinement, and I got a little bit added on to my time there, you know. And it was really kind of petty, you know. It was no big time thing. But, you know, I made it big time when I got out, you know. I've been to Civil Brand, you know. Big time thief. I was a petty shoplifter, actually, and just wrote bad checks, you know. But I always seemed to make a bigger deal out of things than they really were. You probably never did that, but anyway, I got out of there. Nobody would pick me up, and I had to wear that outfit for downtown LA. I was going to get mugged, but I never went back. Almost I did. I went back to jail one more time after that, and just really slipping and sliding downhill, and I was doing a lot of things trying to hold it together, and one more time the relationship had failed. And I had several jobs going, and I was bartending and dog grooming and, you know, anything that, you know, you didn't have to commit to. And I went on a week's binge and never slept for a week. Took Benny's, you know, but those are cross tops. Anyway, I took those and the whole week, and I guess I was in an accident. Hit my head on a windshield, I was crushed ice. A couple other things, you know. And Saturday night, just before the end of this run, I had fallen asleep at the bar and was talking to this woman, and thought I woke up, and I said, gee, sorry I fell asleep, you know, it's not the company. And she said, you can fall asleep. You've been talking, we've been sharing. So really, what did I share? my life story, I hope not. Anyway, I didn't say anything, but here's what I thought. I was very ignorant about alcoholism. I didn't know about blackouts. My mother had never shared that with me. And so what I thought was, you know, I thought I was special and different. I thought I'd been in astral trouble. And I swear to God, I thought, wow, I have gone someplace and nobody knows where that is. And I don't remember it. But I could probably get back there if I did this again for another week and live to tell about it, you know. But I really left. I'd done after traveling. I thought it was just some. That was really weird. And next morning I was at a bar bright and early at 6. And it had gotten so bad my mouth was cracked and bleeding, my tongue was. And you would have thought I'd stop right now. They gave me a drink with a straw so I could bypass that. And then I went home and collapsed. And I don't recall ever repeating that to that extent again, but I was a little more cautious, I think, because it was scary. And so, at any rate, I went on like that for quite a while. And then, of course, before I moved up to Santa Rosa, I was drinking with some friends, and I think it was like about 5th at Tequila, the bar that we were playing at. And I went to go home. And I insisted on driving, because I do everything better when I'm drunk, especially that drunk. And so this person let me drive, and I had these blackouts. So I'd be driving along, and be all black. And I'd come to, and I'd be about 3 blocks away. I thought, this is very strange. And I did that about 3 or 4 times, and the last thing I remembered was a double-door garage, which happened to be a van, and I hit it. And the next thing I remember is some officer asking me to see the alphabet. Right. And so I got the E, and I couldn't remember what came after that, so I assaulted him. And I always thought the best defense was an offense, you know. And I said, I bet you don't know what comes after E. And they egged him on to tell me. And he wouldn't bite for it, and so I said, Warren, you do the alphabet. How many times do you do that a day? So he threw me in the squad car and put me to jail. And by this time, my drinking really had failed me, and I had become kind of a street chemist. And those of you who are street chemists know what I mean. I'm going into it. And it didn't help. I either did add a little pinch of this, a pinch of that, maybe sometimes too much a pinch, you know. Right over the edge. And so you know how they ask you to empty your pockets. You know, I empty my pockets, and the thing called the joint rolled out. But he's real alcoholic, you don't know what that is. And I am a real alcoholic, you know. That's two things you haven't noticed. Anyway, so it rolled out on the table, and I just about died. My roommate, who was with me, had just been talking the entire time. I kept saying, shh, 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 you know. Well, when they opened hers, about 4 of them thought she shut up. She never said another word. I still had one in my pocket, and I thought, oh, my God, they find two. You know, big deal, you know. Anyway, they put us in jail, and so then they could take your shoes off. And from then and over again, she found me eating that joint. I didn't want them to find it on me. And I got, you know, now it's my little bag. Probably had stuff all over my mouth, you know. It was probably pitiful. Can't you just imagine that drunk, saying, oh, no, I'm going to eat this evidence. I'm going to eat this evidence. Yeah, this is big time. They'll send me to the pen and have flaky stuff that looks like oregano all over your teeth, you know. So there was no room in the jail, so I had to sleep on the floor. Thank God I ate that too, you know what I mean? Anyway, I wake up the next morning, everybody's gone. I can figure it out, you know. But I started singing Jailhouse Blues song. Trouble in my own. You know, they just came by and banged on the door and told me, shut up. And they had no musical sense. Anyway, that's what my life was. You know, I'd come from really a young person that was full wife and really wanted to go someplace with my life and to do things. Had good moral training from my grandma and my grandpa. Had a good work ethic. Always wanted to do right. But somehow or another, I couldn't always come talk about it in the book. Couldn't always accomplish that. Couldn't always carry that off. But I wanted to do good. It was a real conflict for me. And it was, I became very guilty and remorseful for the things that I did. Stole money from my friends and these other things. And so that's where I was. And I felt like I'd been everywhere in the world. You know, and I'd only been to Tijuana, Mexico, you know. But I felt I'd done everything and been everywhere and had this big hole in my stomach. And I decided that I needed to get back to my roots. I needed to get to the country. And so I moved to Santa Rosa, California. And I know today that it was divine. I decided that I needed to get back to my roots. I needed to get to the country. And so I moved to Santa Rosa, California. And I know today that it was divine intervention. So I moved to Santa Rosa, California, and I moved in with 10 other women. It was they called it the witch's coven. I didn't know that. I didn't. I missed that in the brochure. But anyway, only ate funny mushrooms and did all sorts of dances in the meadow naked, but I could never make it to the naked, the meadow because of the Jack Daniels, you know. And I never liked dancing and laughing anyway, but anyway, so they ran naked around the property, they accessorized with feathers and crystals and belts with a knife, you know, it was very, very exotic, you know. I did not do that, but I can report on it, you know, because they were insane, and I wasn't. Yeah, then 2 weeks they asked me to move, and I refused, because you see, I've always liked being where I wasn't wanted, so I refused to move, and along the way, say to Providence, say, along the way I met some people, and they were going to Al-Anon. I thought, that's a good place for me to go. Actually, I had a crush on one of them, and I thought I'd go to a meeting. And it says in the 12 by 12, I wouldn't get here by any kind of virtue, and that's certainly my case. But I went to Al-Anon, and I learned a lot, and I cried a lot, and they cried a lot, and there was a lot of crying going on in those Al-Anon meetings. And right next door was an AA meeting, and they were laughing. I thought, who knew what they're laughing about in there? What the hell could be so funny? They quit drinking and are laughing? Are they nuts? And so I've been in Al-Anon a while, and I had an Al-Anon sponsor and a counselor, and she came to me and she said, "Jimmy, I can't help you till you get a grip on your drinking." She said, "I can't tell a real or made up crazy." But I'll show you a crazy. I'm going to go into one right now. You're abandoning me, you know. So I was so insulted. But really what I heard her say was that I was hopeless. There was no help for me. And so I didn't talk to her for 2 years. And 2 years I did go back and make amends to her. But I did go to AA. You know, I had some suspicions about it. I took my mother to her first AA meeting. I did. And I took her there, and we sat down, and it was a birthday meeting. They had cake, you know how they do, and all the same. Happy, joyous, and free on birthday night. The rest of the year was fine, but that's the night we love. And so there was a lot of happiness going on, and there were a lot of older people. And I thought, this is great. Mother's going to find a husband. And I'll be rid of her. And you know, she stayed sober for 6 months. Did I do something wrong?
Nope.
Okay. Want to do good for the committee. Anyway, so after 6 months, my mama drank again. I took her every morning. I'd drop her off, go up a few little drinks, come pick her up. And so after 6 months, she drank again. And I said, "Mama, how can you drink?" And she said, "They wouldn't sponsor me." I said, "Who?" "She was just at that club." And I said, "You're kidding." mounted my white horse, put my white hat on, and I went down there. And I said, I want to talk to the manager of this purchase. Right now. Don't you know who I am? I have a complaint. And there was this little lady there, she was terrific, and she said, hello, Jim. You know how they are. Hello. Come sit down over here. I'll talk to you. Nobody else would. And she was fearless and thorough from the very beginning. And she said, I know your mama. She said, she's constitutionally incapable of being honest with herself. And she hadn't asked anybody to be her sponsor. And I said, well, how does this work? And so she told me a little bit about it. That was my first exposure to AA. I'd grown up not trusting and not sharing, and so when I, at this point in Santa Rosa, when I went to AA, I was still not very trusting, you know, and I didn't trust you at all, actually, as well, apparently. And so when I went to my first meeting at Santa Rosa, you announced yourself as a newcomer, like in the news, and I said, my name is Dorothy. Just in case. And in case I missed a meeting, you may complain. But that's what I thought they did. Once you committed, if you didn't show up, they'd come to your house and say, hey, get to the meeting. Well, they'd never find Dorothy. Anyway, we'd write the names down, and she'd use the list, and I'd put Dorothy down. And she'd go down the list, she'd call Dorothy, and they'd all look around for Dorothy. And I'd say, I think Dorothy left. Worked quite well for 60 days. Never read any of the literature. Had it all at my house, got the book, got all the pamphlets. Put it in the bathroom like they said to do. You know, didn't read it. And at 60 days, I went down to L.A. and some people had told me, advised me not to. Therefore, I went and took my book and my pamphlets. And I went door to door to all my friends and said, I'm an AA. And I took a case of college soda with me so I'd have something to drink. And they weren't very impressed. They just thought it was one of my things. That's nice. I found out later they were afraid to say these things, you know. Like, thank God, you know. And so I was just there a couple of days, and a friend said, would you like a brandy and soda? And I said, sure. You know, life, I mean, I need to tell you, life got better right away. It got better right away. Because at that point, I was like throwing up blood, and I called them tremors. Other people called them mini grandmas or mini moms. Shake right out of your boots, you know. And I'd stop doing that. I was on time to work. Showed up at work. Things have gotten better. Nothing wrong. No problems. Not financially, spiritually, not emotionally. And I said, yeah, thanks. And that was my last drink. And that was November 23rd, 1978. That was my last drink. And never drank again. No thanks to me. No thanks to AA. And we went out to the bar. I never got drunk. Did the same thing we've always done. We ordered three for me and one for you. At the last call, I ordered four for me and you got your own. That was the last time I drank. Never got drunk. And I went back to my mother's. We pulled out the big book. I knew there was an answer in there. There was an answer for me. I just didn't know what it was yet, but I knew. I knew. And I don't know what I read. I don't know. Two lies after. Who knows, you know. Didn't really matter. Back then, I was searching for the solution in the book. I knew the solution was there, and I knew that I was the problem. And I think those are the two basic things that Joe and Charlie talk about. Got to recognize what the problem is. Got to know what the solution is. And then I went back to Santa Rosa, and I said, my name is Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. And then I looked for the action that would help me get the solution. And I had a lot of help. You know, I had a wonderful sponsor. My first sponsor, you guys, she was really big and really mean looking. I thought, that's what I need. Somebody to whip me in shape. Unfortunately, she was also very nice. And she was very good to me. She was very good to me, but she was funny. She gave me a thing that said, you were looking at the problem, and she said, put that on your bathroom window, or bathroom mirror. So every morning you can look at that. And so I did. And then I put her picture right next to it. And I never let her in my bathroom. I knew she was coming, and I ripped that off of that. At about a year, she came back from a conference called Living Sober, and she said, I've got this great thing for you, Julie. It really applies. Oh, okay. I thought it was pretty spiritual. And she said, if you're having problems practicing these principles in all your affairs, you're having too many affairs. What do you mean, Leslie? In my first year, I joined a group of women in recovery, and I had about 2 months sober, and we formed a group called Brown Bag Readers Theater. And we wrote recovery stories, and then we went before people who wanted to recover, and we read those stories and asked through a kind of a printed out thing, and we shared, and it kept me sober. And I did that for about 6 months. And that group went on for another 15 years. And helped a lot of people, but it wasn't something that I was going to continue to do in my life. But they're very wonderful women, and I'm grateful to say that most of them, I believe all of them, are still sober. Some had slips and came back. But recently I got reunited with them, and it was a wonderful experience, and we laughed about how crazy we were in our first year. I mean, you know, going to a dance, I mean, like, oh, God, you know, why do I have to do this? Just because my sponsor said so, you know? And you stand around and you go, Charlie is on the moon. And you know you're the center of the universe, and everybody's just standing around going, ah, look how uncoordinated she is, you know. And you just know that, you know, and it's not true, but well, maybe it was, I'm not sure. But anyway, that was a wonderful experience for me. And for my first 5 years, I did service. My sponsor got me after Brown Bag to be a secretary of the meeting. I had done coffee. I had done the chairs. I had washed every ashtray imaginable. That time we had ashtrays. We had smoking. And so I'd done all that. I'd set up the meeting. I broke the meeting down. I'd done all that. So it's my turn to be secretary. Oh, so really, I said, okay. So about, oh, I guess, 4 weeks into it, she says, well, how do you like being secretary, you know? And I said, you know, it's a lot like bowling. You have to be here every week and there's no subs. And I said, I don't much like it. She said, well, you'll do it anyway. And I said, of course. And then I saw my buddy Carl and I would complain about it. But I did that, and I did intergroup prep, and I wasn't quite ready for GSR. Didn't have enough sobriety. That took me about 10 years. And anyway, my recovery went on, and I'll tell the story about, you know, changing your playpen and the people you play with. And so I went to my commune, you know, the witch's coven, and told them I couldn't see them anymore. I cried. They just went, okay. No big deal. It was very dramatic. Everything was very dramatic. One of the things that was really hard for me in my first year was that I had seen David Wine and Rosie. So I had thought I should detox like that. And I didn't. And so I didn't think I was an alcoholic. And I was complaining about that to my sponsor. She said, don't worry, the answer will come. So I left her house one night and I was driving and I drove by this barn. I was a damn neon light, you know. As I drove by, I kid you not, I could taste and smell Jack Daniels going down my throat. I was thrilled. I was thrilled to death. I rushed back to her house. I am an alcoholic. She said, no kidding. In sobriety, I've had many, many opportunities, because when you're sober, you're presented with lots of opportunities. You're given lots of chances I should never have been given for the things that I've done. And I feel blessed with the things that have happened to me in my life. And one of the things that happened to me was that I had quit school and I felt ignorant and stupid. And so I went back to college only to walk through that fear. And so I went back to college, didn't know what I was going to do, took courses, worked them through the program one day at a time, one test at a time, one semester at a time. And as a result, in 1985, I graduated with a nursing degree and an AA degree. And I started meeting on campus, because I needed one on campus. We're proud of that, because they gave that to me. But you see, today is a product of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so then I left and I moved to Chico. And I was sober 7 years. That was scary. Leaving my hometown where I got sober was scary. You know, the only time I had left was on my first year birthday, and I went down south because I was afraid they wouldn't give me a cake. So I went down to L.A., and they gave me a cake. It was great. Anyway, so I moved to Chico, California, and also, and I applied for a job at a hospital over there. And before I applied, I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to a meeting. And I wanted to know, would I be able to fit in there? Would that be a place for me to be? And I went to a meeting, and it was a place called Mom's. Right away, I liked it. And they were rowdy and banging on the table and just full of life and talking AA. And I thought, I could do that. I can do that here. You know, just like them. And so I applied for the job and got it, and I moved to Chico, and I left my recovery family over there. And I never lost touch with them, but I didn't know so, and I made a new family. Because there's a fellow that says is that strangers in AA are just friends you haven't met yet. And you know that's true, and we showed that to them this weekend. You've come up and you've welcomed me here, and you've given me a lot of love. Give me a lot of support sitting up here. This is not easy. You know, when I used to be the one that sat in the back and the speaker would get up and I'd go, I don't believe half of what that guy said. I don't believe her. You know, I could have done that better. And at 60 days, I asked my sponsor, I said, how do you become a circuit speaker? She said, do you have something to say? I'm not sure she'd agree I had something to say today. That's probably not true, because she saw me go through all the changes. At any rate, I worked as a nurse there. Some of the other things that have happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous is that you've taught me to walk through fear. And by doing that fourth step, I got to see what my fears were. And one of them was that I always felt vulnerable, and I always felt if I was too feminine, that you could get me. And so I was pretty gruff, pretty macho. And so what you taught me to do in here was to soften up. And I wear suits today. I don't have it on today because my grandma dressed me. She told me this is the outfit I should wear. And she said, to tell you, she was sorry, but she didn't have a lot to work with. See, just like a sponsor, you know. At any rate, I got to work in that hospital. I got injured. I was a trauma nurse. I got injured, and so I thought my nursing career was over. And God said, well, I have another plan for you. And I want you to start an EAP program where nobody's helping these impaired nurses and these impaired pharmacists and these other people, and they don't have a program here. So I became a representative of the diversion program for the state of California for nurses, and I started a recovery group, support group for them, and I worked with pharmacists, and I worked with physicians. I helped them set up their own recovery support group, and it was a miracle. It was wonderful. With a half-time position, I did it full-time, because I went to all the meetings, you know, and they were assigned to go to meetings. So they would see me once a week, and I would see them at meetings, you know, sitting in the back row, you know, where all the half meters and flippers sit. Anyway, we're the latecomers. And so I'd see them at the next session, and I'd say, you know, recovery's at the table. And so they'd have to get up to the table, you know. They'd come into a meeting and see me, and they'd go, right to the table. I like that kind of power. I don't know. At any rate, I worked at that hospital, started that program, started another nursing program for home infusion therapy with a friend of mine who's now my partner of 12 years. We started our own business, home infusion therapy business, when it was brand new. I got to do some exciting things. We wrote a book. We sold it all over the United States and in 3 countries. We flew everywhere. We had a grand time. God's been very good to me. And we had a joyous experience doing that. For 5 years, we sold our business, and my mother came to live with me in 1991 after a stroke. I never thought that I owed my mother amends. So when my sponsor told me to read Freedom from Bondage, I was pretty new, and I thought, well, I've never been into that sort of thing. He said, read it anyway, you know. And this is so true. You know, I'd nurtured this resentment from my mother. I'd cultivated it. It was like a delicate plant. And I didn't want to get rid of it. It was my reason for living. You know, and I had to get rid of it or die. I believe Charlie and Joe talked about that. Any life around self-will is not a successful life. Any life that is full of resentments is not going to be a successful life in recovery. So I had to get rid of that. So I started sending my mother cards on time. And I started getting her birthday presents to her on time. You know, her birthday was April 6th, and she'd get her card and present in July. You know, and I started doing that. Started being kind to her and visiting her. And then when she was sick, she came to live with me, and I had a real opportunity to do amends to my mother. I had harmed my mother in ways that I didn't understand. But I had harmed her. She wanted grandchildren. That was not to be my life. And she was bitterly disappointed, and I hurt her. And so I looked at the way that I'd hurt her, and so now she came and she had a stroke, and she was paralyzed on the right side. She was a prideful alcoholic who did not like having people take care of her. And I took care of her for 9 months, and we were very close. And I'll never regret that time. My mother was, she could be kind of nasty, but she became very soft in the last days of her life. And she used to reach up with her good hand and just pat me on the cheek. My mother never touched me, emotionally or physically. And so I'll never forget that experience. And when she got sick and died, I'd lost kind of my reason for living, really. I felt very, very, very depressed and suicidal. And thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. I got people that came by and would stop just in promptly, and I'd be sitting there with a gun. I really didn't want to kill myself. But I didn't have the courage to do that. And I thought she wanted me to be with her. And I went back to Missouri, and I have my own plot now. I got my headstone and everything. I mean, I went to town on this. And I may never be buried there, and don't wonder what happened. But that's the only lady in the cemetery. She's still alive. I'll put on their Alcoholics Never Die. They just stay away. Anyway, so I did all that, and it was what I had to do to get through that. And I had a lot of love and a lot of caring. My partner had gone to Oregon to work, and so I went up there, and I went to work, and tried to get through this. It was the most difficult thing I'd ever been through. And we'll share this, and then I'll sit down. But I want to tell you that, once again, God worked in my life. There was a woman there at a meeting, and I was crying. And most of the guys there said, get out there, let them. Oh, yourself up by your bootstraps. And I said, I'll tell you what I said, but they moved away from me. And a very nice lady came up, and she said, honey, let's sit down and talk after the meeting. I said, okay. And we sat down, and she became a very good friend of me. And she said, you know, what you're afraid of is that you won't be loved. That you're not going to get the love that you felt like you got, the unconditional love of your mother. And she said, you'll get it, and you'll get it here. And it's going to start with me. And I didn't know that her cancer had activated and that she was to die in about 2 months. But she gave me so much love and brought me back from wherever the hell I was going. And at any rate, I worked at a job, and I was working at a hospital, and I've become extremely disabled with degenerative bone disease that runs in my family. Thank you, Dad. And gave me my alcoholism and bad bones. Anyway, it's all his fault, right, Charlie? Yeah, I'll tell you, that's why I drink. No. Anyway, I had to quit that job and go on disability, and I was surprised I wouldn't go on Social Security for a year and a half. Because somebody said, you have to go on Social Security, you can't work. I'm like, oh. I was in denial because I didn't want to quit. Anyway, the greatest gift of all. I go on this, and I'm doing service now. And I go to lots of meetings. I sponsor people. I'm involved again. And I love it. And I get to come around and meet people like you. And I get to share. And this story is, like, boring, you know. I reviewed it all night last night. And I thought, that's boring. I think I should make some stuff up. Maybe a blackout to the Caribbean or something. That's exciting. But my life is not boring today. What it's like for me today is the most exciting part of my life. And I can't describe it to you. You already know. Those of you that are experiencing that, know. I like what Patsy told me the first day I'm there. She says it's the first part is surviving, the next part is thriving. And that's where my life is today. I may be physically, you know, a little worse off than some, but I soar in my heart and in my spirit, and it is always fine. My friend Keith came last year to our roundup. I'm a chairperson this year, and I love meeting people from out of town. I love hearing your stories, too, you know. The best part of meetings is getting to know you. I want to end with this prayer that my grandma gave me. My grandma doesn't understand alcoholism. She just says things like, why don't you just quit? I said, I did, several times. But she has a great sense of humor, and so I want to end. I always end with this because I love it, because she intuitively knows me. And it says, dear Lord, so far today I've done all right. I haven't gossiped, haven't lost my temper, haven't been greedy, grumpy, nasty, selfish, or overindulgent. I'm really glad about that. But in a few minutes, I'm going to get out of bed. And from then on, I'm going to need a lot more help. Thank you.